Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. On today's programme, a small German town struggles to cope with the Germanwings disaster.
If you look at other parts of the world, life is totally different, but in Haltern life is safe. I mean, in Germany we have such high safety levels. But now we all of a sudden realise no matter how much you try, no system is faultless. Something can always, always happen, and that is what happened now to this ill-fated flight.
Also on Inside Europe, has the Ukrainian conflict rehabilitated Europe's last dictator? Religious tensions in Turkey's refugee camps, and how the homeless in Athens are becoming tour guides. Those stories and more coming up. Investigations are continuing into the disaster of Germanwings flight 4U9525, which crashed in the French Alps en route from Barcelona to Düsseldorf. While details continue to emerge as to what exactly happened on the doomed plane, Europeans have been coming together to mourn the 150 victims. The passengers included 16 teenage students and two teachers from the German town of Haltern. They'd been in Spain on a language exchange program. The mayor of Haltern, Bodo Kimpel, said it was the darkest day in the town's history.
I can only say that the town is in shock. You can feel it everywhere in our community. This is the worst thing you can possibly imagine.
Most of the passengers on the flight were German or Spanish, but there were many other nationalities on board. And in the wake of the tragedy, politics are taking a back seat. Karl Nasman has more.
The plane took off from Spain, was bound for Germany, and it tragically crashed in France. The leaders of those three countries helped guide the grieving process this week.
Der Absturz der deutschen Maschine mit über 140 Menschen an Bord ist ein Schock.
C'est une tragédie, une nouvelle tragédie aérienne. Nous aurons aussi à connaître.
The 150 people on board belong to at least 13 different nations, including many in Europe. At least 50 Spaniards and more than 70 Germans lost their lives. Memorials were held across Europe this week for the victims of the first crash of a European airliner since 2009. For now, political disagreements have been put on hold, and instead the continent is grieving together. Among the passengers were employees of German pharmaceutical company Bayer and Spanish clothing firm Desigual. There were also two rising stars of European opera, German Maria Rodner and Oleg Brizhak of Kazakhstan. They had just performed in Barcelona before boarding the plane. The disaster hit one small town in western Germany particularly hard. 16 students and two teachers from Josef Kunig High School in Haltern were on board the flight. Deutsche Welle's Daniel Peltz grew up in Haltern and used to attend the same high school as the victims.
I was, of course, concerned. I wanted to find out whether I know the teachers who were on board. And I wanted to know from what families the kids were coming from, because I know most of the families by name, and my parents who still live in Haltern know most of the people in Haltern even personally.
Daniel told me the crash was a shock and a wake-up call for those living in Haltern.
If you look at other parts of the world, life is totally different, but in Haltern life is safe. I mean, if something like this happens, we are all of a sudden reminded that life is always dangerous. I mean, in Germany we have such high safety levels. But now we all of a sudden realize no matter how much you try, no system is faultless. Something can always, always happen, and that is what happened now to this ill-fated flight.
Haltern has received support from all over Europe this week, but Daniel thinks European politics might soon reclaim the headlines.
Europe is going to return to its old self pretty soon. I mean, you can also see here in Germany, all of us are pretty much focused on the German victims. Of course, we had stories in the media about the Spanish victims as well, but you can see our prime focus, and I can understand that, are the German victims. And I think at the moment we have very, very deep divisions, political divisions in Europe, and I don't think that such a plane crash can put an end to that divisions. But what I do hope is even for a week or so, it's good if people come together in their mourning. It definitely can't do any harm.
And that mourning right now extends across Europe, from a small town in Germany to the home countries of the opera singers who were also on the flight. For DW, this is Carl Nassmann.
Turkey is now hosting nearly 2 million Syrian refugees and spending billions of dollars on camps for them. Many of them are Yazidi Kurds, also known as Yezidis, who follow an ancient religion. But the Yezidis are shunning the Turkish-run camps for those organised by a pro-Kurdish group, and that's provoked a political row in Turkey. Dorian Jones reports from a Yezidi camp in Diyarbakir, in the predominantly Kurdish southeast of the country.
The Chinar refugee camp is one of a network of 11 camps set up by local authorities under the control of the pro-Kurdish HDP, People's Democracy Party. The camp was set up in a matter of days after thousands of Yezidis turned up at Turkey's doorstep. Yezidis are Kurds who follow an ancient religion and, as refugee Miksabi Suleiman explains, Islamic State militants, or Daesh as he calls them, have particularly strong hatred for Yezidis.
Early in the evening, we were celebrating a religious festival. Then people said there were cars surrounding a nearby village. We knew they were Daesh and they would be coming for us next. Our community tried to protect itself, but when Daesh came, we couldn't resist for long. There were too many of them with too many guns. So many people died fighting them. They show no mercy to us. They see us as heretics. We had to flee. There is no way any human can stand against them. The ones they caught were beheaded. Men, women, children. We ran to the mountains. We spent weeks there. Eventually, we were rescued by the PKK, the Kurdish fighters from Turkey, who took us to safety.
Listening is Suleiman's wife. Reaching this camp has special meaning.
When Daesh came, I was about to give birth. I had to walk in the mountains for a week. It was so hard. For days and nights, we slept under trees until we found safety here. The same day we arrived, I gave birth to my beautiful son.
Showing me around the camp, director Metin Palodokem says nearly 4,000 Yezidis live here now. He says they have a women's center and that a school will be opened in the coming weeks. But Palodokhen says the key priority is winning the Yezidis' trust.
Yezidis have been massacred over the centuries 74 times. Because of this, they don't trust anyone, especially Muslim societies. But in these last 4 months, we succeeded in gaining their trust, and now we work together with them in the coordination of the camp.
Yezidi refugees make up 12 of the 15 members of the committee that runs the camp. Suleiman says there is a sense of freedom in the camp, especially for their religious beliefs.
I spoke to my friends when I first came here, and none of us had any problems here. You know, the thing that the Yezidis are most sensitive about is their religion. If our religion gets attacked by someone, it's a big problem for us. But we haven't had any such experience here.
One of the first decisions of the camp committee was to have classes taught in Kurdish, the mother tongue of most Yezidis. That is contentious, as Kurdish is still banned in Turkey's state schools. And in Turkish state refugee camps, the language in schools is strictly Arabic. Turkey's ruling AK party is more than a little suspicious about such camps and have refused to offer financial assistance. Fatma Öncü is a member of the National Committee of the AK Party from Diyarbakır. She claims Yezidis are being manipulated by local Kurdish politicians to promote their agenda.
Their political agenda is different. They want to get the attention of international media by using the Yezidi refugees. We are providing perfectly adequate camps, and it's important that they stay in these state camps with their better standards and where their children can get educated. We have sociologists and psychiatrists. The state camps have all kinds of people who have fled from the war. There are Kurds and Arabs. But I have to admit, Yezidis don't want to go to these camps.
Even though Turkish state camps are far more comfortable with more amenities, many Yazidis say they're reluctant to go to government camps because they say they would have to share space with Arabs. Many say even the presence of a mosque in these camps is threatening. The Chinar camp is filled with horror stories and traumatic experiences, many at the hands of Islamic State militants who carried out their crimes in the name of Islam. As refugee Mihim Ibrahim Ido explains.
We don't want to live with Arabs. We don't want to see them again. My neighbors were Arabs, and those who wanted to kill me were Arabs. I lived in Iraq with Arabs for 30 years. Even if I have to fight 20 more years, I will not have my children go back and live with them again.
Listening, Mixabi Suleiman shows me documents that he claims proves he's worked with the US Army. He says he's already applied for refugee status in America. Suleiman, like many Yazidis here, see no future in Iraq or Syria. They say asylum in Europe or the United States is their only chance. Dorian Jones, DW, Chinar Refugee Camp, Diyarbakir, Southeast Turkey.
And I'm Helen Senian-Bon. You're listening to Inside Europe. The former Soviet Republic of Belarus has acted as a mediator in negotiations to broker peace in Ukraine. Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko has rubbed shoulders with EU leaders and Russian President Vladimir Putin on several occasions, most notably during the recent talks in the Belarusian capital, Minsk. Before the Ukrainian crisis, though, Lukashenko was shunned by Western politicians due to his poor human rights record and his disdain for democracy. The apparent change of heart towards Lukashenko has been criticized by Belarusian dissidents who have moved to neighboring Poland because of repression back home. They point out that nothing much has changed in Belarus. It still has political prisoners, while its media are the most tightly controlled in Europe. Rafał Kipuszewski has more from Warsaw.
The only way for Belarusian TV viewers to get free and uncensored news from home and the outside world is by watching this channel beamed by satellite from the Polish capital, Warsaw. The station called Belsat is run by a partnership of Belarusian journalists and former Polish anti-communist oppositionists. Belsat presenters like Dima Hudnevich were all forced to leave their country over the past two decades by the repressive regime of President Alexander Lukashenko. For Dima, the final straw was the day when he was arrested while working as a freelancer for Western media at an opposition rally in Minsk.
In my journalist career, I spent 10 days in the prison. It was probably the first experience of my job. The law in Belarus is very strange. If you don't have an accreditation, you cannot work like as a journalist. I didn't have permission because if you want to have permission, you should have thousands and thousands documents. It's almost impossible to have legal documents to be journalists in Belarus if you not working for government.
Tonight's featured guest on Belsat television is Alex Bialyatsky, head of the Vyasna Human Rights Center, which provides financial and legal assistance to Belarusian political prisoners and their families. Bialyatsky recently spent 20 months in jail on trumped-up charges of tax evasion and was only released following international pressure. In this interview, he says that human rights campaigners still face prison sentences in Belarus for what the authorities describe as anti-state activities. Bialyatsky explains that non-governmental organizations are denied funding and their members are harassed by the police. Belsat Television itself has been repeatedly refused official registration by the Minsk authorities, which means that under Belarusian law, the station is illegal and those working for it do so at their own risk. Belsat director Agnieszka Romaszewska, a former Polish Solidarity opposition activist, explains that her team is willing to take that risk, even if winning EU and US funding for the station is proving more and more difficult.
Because Belarus is our neighbor, we have to think very carefully about our relations with this country. Some people in Western Europe, they just even don't realize that there's something between Poland and Russia. Probably it still is not in the consciousness of Europeans.
In recent months, Belarusian dissidents living in Poland have become very critical of what they see as the West turning a blind eye to the Minsk authorities' human rights abuses. The European Union and the United States, they say, are trying to resolve the conflict in eastern Ukraine with Alexander Lukashenko's help, over the heads of the Belarusian opposition. Sasha Papko, a Belarusian analyst with the CASE think tank in Warsaw, believes that Lukashenko is playing a game using the West for his own ends.
Lukashenko tries to sell his neutrality in the conflict to the West. So he presents himself as an ally of Moscow, and also he presents himself as a guarantee of Belarusian independence. He's trying to blackmail both sides, both Russia and the West. So he's not sincere in what he's saying.
Meanwhile, Poland and neighboring Lithuania appear more cautious in dealing with Belarus. They have stepped up cross-border radio broadcasts into the country, both in the Russian language, spoken by over 80% of the population, and in Belarusian, which is favored by the opposition. Euroradio is one of three stations with studios in Poland and transmitters in Lithuania aimed at younger Belarusians. Journalist Dima Hurniewicz is convinced that Belarusian audiences need such broadcasts more than ever before, at a time when the government-controlled media keep boasting of President Lukashenko's diplomatic successes.
We have just the same information, the same news all the time. People in Belarus, they understand that their life is not the best in the world, but they don't understand who is guilty of this. They cannot travel around the world, so they believe TV, newspapers, the radio, because they don't have other information.
Presidential elections in Belarus are scheduled for November, and oppositionists fear that voter apathy, combined with official propaganda, may once again lead to a victory for President Lukashenko. Analyst Sasha Papko of the CASE think tank believes that instead of flirting with Lukashenko, the EU should consider taking some practical steps to break the vicious circle in one of Europe's least open societies.
The only one thing should be done, it's visa liberalization for Belarusians, because if you allow people to go to Europe, they will have a possibility to compare. And the comparison, of course, it will be beneficial for the European choice. So you should establish direct personal link between Belarusians and people in Lithuania, Poland, Czech Republic, etc.
This approach seems to have worked in Ukraine. Its citizens have traveled freely to Poland and further west in their millions, not just in search of better paid jobs, but also to experience democracy in action. The result was the pro-European Maidan revolution against a corrupt and repressive regime, a prospect which surely keeps haunting the Belarusian president in his nightmares. The challenge for the West right now is to bring about change in Belarus in a way that doesn't lead to more bloodshed. Rafał Kipuszewski, DW, Warsaw.
Due to the financial crisis, the number of Greeks living on the streets has skyrocketed over the past few years. Greece lacks a strong social safety net, and a lot of social and health services have been cut back. After 2 years of state-sponsored assistance, people who have run out of luck turn to their families for help, or they end up homeless. In Athens, homeless people have started to give tours. not of the Acropolis or other historic sites, but of soup kitchens and drug treatment centres. Sonia Dean has more.
Christos Bakayanis has tried just about every drug, from cocaine to heroin. Although he's been clean for 7 years, it's hard for people like him to find work in crisis-struck Greece. And without a job, Bakayanis can't afford a place to live. He just turned 50 and stays in an empty warehouse. But he's not wallowing in self-pity. Bakayanis has been able to earn a few euros by guiding tourists around Athens. He's indicating the location where junkies shoot up, and then where he set out to kick the habit all those years ago. Near Amanoia Square, he points to a rundown office building.
Luckily, the city opened up its so-called shooting gallery here. It's a space where drug addicts can get clean needles and, above all, help. They're offered treatment for withdrawal symptoms.
A good dozen people are listening to Bakayanis. A female tourist from Germany, a visitor from Italy, and mostly Athenians who had no idea about this dark side to their own city. They peer into rear courtyards where homeless people sleep on beds of cardboard at night. And they visit soup kitchens where destitute elderly line up in tattered jackets every day for a free lunch. Labros Moustakis, the other guide on this tour, says that earlier he had a normal life, family, work, a home. But then his marriage fell apart, he lost his job, and he could no longer pay the rent. For months, Moustakis slept outside on park benches. Now he's sharing a room in a state-run shelter with an Iranian refugee. He's standing in front of a bare 10-story high-rise at Vathi Square.
Residents here are between 18 and 80 years old. Two-thirds of them are men, a third women. We're technically only allowed to live here 1 year max, but the city of Athens has now extended that to 3 years. But they're even not too strict about that, because otherwise the person would be homeless again. We don't have 300 euros a month for an apartment.
After becoming unemployed, Greek people get about 2 years of benefits. There's no long-term welfare, although there are plans to introduce that soon. If they can't find another job, then they're on their own. Jobless, often turn to family, or they end up on the streets. Recovered addict Bakayanis is happy that he can do some work as a tour guide.
If I can use my experience to get others to help homeless people, well, that's great. If people are moved to give something, that would make me happy.
Tour customer Vicky Pasumenu has gotten the message. She lives in a more prosperous neighborhood in Athens where the streets are lined with beautiful estates and manicured yards. She's deeply moved by the tour and, above all, by the tour guide.
I can only recommend this tour. These people have incredible abilities. With support, they can accomplish a lot.
For 2 hours every Saturday, Bakayanis, Moustakis, and other homeless people in Athens guide their guests through what they call an invisible route in their city. Of the 6 euros each tour guest pays, 3 go to the Athens homeless newspaper Shadia, which organizes the tour. The homeless guides get the other half. Although this may not seem like a lot, the intangible exchange makes the homeless tours even more valuable for both guide and tourist.
And that was Sonia Dean. If you'd like to send us your feedback on the show, our email address is europe@dw.de. We'd love to hear from you. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. This is Inside Europe and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. Over the next half hour, we're focusing on Europe's border-free zone. 30 years ago, 5 EU member states signed up to the Schengen Agreement. That accord would dramatically change travel and migration within the bloc. It gradually eliminated internal border controls and established a common visa policy. Today, 22 of the 28 EU member states are part of the Schengen area, as well as 4 countries outside of the EU. The Schengen Agreement means over 400 million people can move freely, along with goods, information and money. Back then, it was a bold step towards an interconnected Europe. But today, are immigration and terrorism, for example, exposing the flaws in the Schengen ideal? Yves Pasquo is the Director of Migration and Mobility Policies at the European Policy Centre in Brussels. I asked him if the lack of internal border controls was jeopardising security within the Schengen zone.
We all know that Schengen is a border-free area within which people are able to move, but a lot of people do forget that within the Schengen Convention, there is a set of measures which are called flanking measures, which deal with security issues, which means that in building this free area, member states have not forgotten to also take into account the security side of this freedom of movement.
But doesn't the lack of internal border checks put more pressure on national security services?
I would say that it does not put more pressure. It requests national security authorities to coordinate their missions with other national security agencies and authorities. And this is all the story of a building of a common area where you have to cooperate and to coordinate with other authorities.
Well, indeed, the Schengen Agreement is based on common and mutual trust. Where are the weak links? Are they primarily the countries which are on the zone's outer borders, perhaps?
Well, it would be very difficult to say in a few words whether or not there are weak links or problems into the Schengen. The Schengen evaluation mechanism has been enhanced in the last couple of months, and decisions have been taken in order to enhance the evaluation on how member states are clearly implementing Schengen rules.
If we move away from security, Schengen allows for the free movement of people, goods, information and money within the zone. Is it going too far to say that that has revolutionised the way people work and do business over the past 20 years?
It's a clear reality, and I clearly think that people do easily forget what is the extremely high added value of the Schengen zone for business, but also for individuals who are now able to move from one country to another without being stopped or their travel to be slowed down. We have to consider that if we were to reinstall internal border checks, for instance, there would be no more any plane, train or any bus arriving on time at the destination. We have to consider that the price of products would increase because the time for your strawberries, for instance, produced in Spain to arrive in the Netherlands would extend, and this has a cost. So there are many, many things and many daily things and many daily added value that people are taking out from the Schengen cooperation, which would disappear if we were to reintroduce internal border checks.
Well, 26 countries belong to Schengen, including 4 which are not members of the European Union. Given the pros and cons of internal free borders, is it likely, do you think, that the remaining 6 EU countries will be signing up in the near future?
Well, we have to distinguish between 2 different categories of member states. We have, on the one hand, member states who do not want to join the Schengen area, and here we can easily quote the UK and Ireland. And on the other hand, we have some member states which are willing to join the Schengen area, but which are not able to do so because some member states do not want. And this is the case of Romania and Bulgaria, which have fulfilled all the conditions to have access to the Schengen zone, but some member states are still very much reluctant to let them in. And as entering the Schengen cooperation is based on a unanimous decision at the level of the Council. As far as there is one member state opposing, then Romania and Bulgaria are remaining outside of the Schengen cooperation.
And that was Yves Pasquo, the Director of Migration and Mobility Policies at the European Policy Centre in Brussels. Well, as we heard there, Schengen is a blessing for travellers and traders, but also for illegal migrants. Once they cross into any Schengen state, they can travel within the continent with far less fear of discovery than before. That places extra pressure on countries along the inside borders of the Schengen area to keep the unwanted out or send them back. The first busload of Kosovar Albanians has just been sent back overland from Hungary to Kosovo. Nick Thorpe sent this report from Budapest.
Outside the bus station in Subotica in northern Serbia in early February, a man from Kosovo told me his story.
Well, we came in the morning here. We got a taxi and they brought us near the border. We walked about 2 miles. I had my young son with me. And we got really tired. We didn't know even where we were going. No, we just kept going around.
His task was to scout out the green border, the woods and fields between Serbia and Hungary, for his group of about 10 fellow Kosovars to cross.
Then we went near the border where the police are, and they told us to go home from Kosovo. So we just walked back here. We meet a lot of people here, so we try again, maybe not.
In the first months of this year, it was the same story all along Hungary's southern border with Serbia. Mostly Kosovars, but also many people from North Africa and the Middle East, all trying to get into Hungary, the first country on their long journey in the Schengen zone, the soft underbelly of Europe. Just across the border inside Hungary, I met a bedraggled group of Afghans keeping warm by a fire, watched over by the Hungarian police. This man held his sick 3-year-old son in his arms. His family had been travelling for 7 months, he said, overland from Kabul. He was afraid his son was going to die. So far this year, nearly 30,000 illegal migrants managed to enter the Schengen area in Hungary along this short section of the border. The Hungarian border police were initially overwhelmed. Zoltán Kovács is the Hungarian government spokesman.
At the moment a refugee enters the Schengen area, then it's basically compulsory for a country and comes for a refugee status. We basically provide a free movement within the European boundaries. So that's what is happening. Over 90% of those entering Hungary are applying for the refugee status and basically dissipate within the European Union within a couple of hours, a couple of days.
In response to the influx, the Hungarian authorities drafted extra police to the border and opened temporary refugee camps. And Germany sent police to patrol the Serbian side of the border with their Serbian colleagues. That has resulted in a big fall in numbers. Meanwhile, those migrants already in Hungary found their route to the west blocked. Here at the East Railway Station in Budapest last month, police formed a line to stop people from Kosovo getting on the train to Munich, even though they had already bought tickets.
I come from Kosovo. All here are from Kosovo. They just want to do a better life. I have someone of my family in Germany, Austria, everywhere. They will help me. They will find me something that I will go for war.
With its border to the south and the west heavily patrolled and police inside the country looking for suspicious groups of people, those Kosovars already in Hungary were stuck. The police were almost as frustrated. Colonel Gizela Vos of the Hungarian Border Police.
If it would be possible, for example, to keep some sort of custody during the asylum procedure, we could deal with the case more easily. But since we are not a target country, the migrants using asylum system of Hungary just for abuse.
At Budapest East Station in mid-February, a policeman read out the names of a group of Kosovars caught on the station. The families were then taken to a waiting police van and sent to an open refugee camp. When they are caught repeatedly trying to cross into Austria, they can be placed in a closed asylum detention centre. Arpad Sape is head of the Refugee Directorate in the Hungarian Immigration Office.
There are various grounds for asylum detention, but it has to be emphasized that the reason for asylum detention is not because of some kind of punishment or retortion because of illegal crossing the borders. Asylum detention is ordered for the sole purpose to ensure the presence of the applicant while the asylum procedure is still ongoing.
In practice, more than 90% of people who ask for asylum in Hungary subsequently disappear. And just over 400 detention orders have been issued so far this year, according to his office. Police forces across Europe have certainly got tougher with those they judge to be economic migrants. At dawn on Wednesday, the first busload of illegal Kosovar migrants was sent back from Hungary to Kosovo, escorted all the way by Serbian police. The message from the Schengen zone countries to Kosovo is a bleak one. You are not welcome here.
And that report was from Nick Thorpe in Budapest. So, even if migrants make it into Europe's Schengen zone, their problems aren't over, especially if they've arrived illegally or as refugees. France's treatment of asylum seekers has earned criticism, most recently in February by the Council of Europe, Europe's top rights body. French lawmakers are now considering a bill trying to improve asylum conditions. France's problems are reflected across the EU, where rights groups say hardening attitudes towards illegal immigration have hurt those who truly need shelter. Lisa Bryant has more from Paris.
About a mile from the city's iconic Montmartre neighborhood is a spot where very few tourists go. It's a busy overpass that houses a collection of small, dirty tents. The metro rumbles overhead, trains pass below.
There are so many people here, not only Ghanas.
The residents of this tent camp mostly come from East Africa. Everybody has a different story, but nobody wanted to end up on this bridge with no toilet, no home, and for now, no future. 24-year-old Mikia says he was a student in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa, before leaving his country in 2013.
Why did you leave Ethiopia?
Because we have a political war. Yeah. Like, you know, ethnic group Oromo. Yeah, I am Oromo.
Mikia says he's applied for asylum in France and received temporary papers. He's waiting for a final interview 6 months from now. Until then, he's stuck in this tent camp.
What did you do in Darfur before you left?
I was studying.
Prazi, who's 25, says he was also a student from Sudan's Darfur region. He says he left because the government harassed him.
As soon as I arrived here, he claimed asylum and from appointment to another appointment, trying to assist accommodation, but nothing will happen. When you go, they say that a lot of people in the queue are waiting, and they came again and came again. Now almost going 1 year and a half.
Rights advocates have heard these kinds of stories many times before. After Germany, France hosts Europe's largest number of asylum seekers, with around 60,000 applicants. Jean-François Dubost, who's in charge of Amnesty International France's Uprooted Peoples Program, says many end up in Paris.
That explains there is a huge problem of reception condition, housing and accommodation for these people. And that's why we can find places where they are just living everywhere in places without nothing.
That's not the way it's supposed to be. Under French law, asylum seekers are entitled to government accommodations while their claims are processed. The EU also sets basic standards that governments must meet. But for now, France simply doesn't have enough places to house them. Pierre-Henri, general director of France Terre d'Asile, an NGO helping asylum seekers here, says it's unacceptable to have tent camps like the one on the bridge.
Là, on regarde la situation sous un pont d'un métro.
Look at the situation on this bridge here in Paris, which is, after all, the capital of our country and a world destination. People who may benefit from asylum are left in the most difficult circumstances. We need to reorganize our asylum system to at least give them shelter and help them as their applications are processed.
Éric Lejoindre agrees that things must change. He's the mayor of Paris's 18th arrondissement, where the tent camp is located.
They come from countries where it's impossible to live, and up to today we haven't had any problems of violence or of theft or whatever. But the campment can't stay. The campment can't stay because it's not a place to live.
A bill in French Parliament aims to address some of the problems. It would cut in half the time to process asylum applications to about 9 months.
And I think it's important that France maintains an asylum policy and that France stays a place where people who seek refuge can find refuge. But everything can't be concentrated around Paris or inside Paris or around Calais. And the country as a whole has to be a part of our asylum policy. And that's the whole point of the reform which is being passed in Parliament.
Amnesty's Dubos says there are positive aspects to the bill, but he's skeptical.
The whole spirit of the law proposed by the French government is quite oriented into the fact to fight against the false refugees. And this is our great concern, that the spirit is not going on the right way.
Rights activists say that's a problem reflected elsewhere in Europe as a region tries to stem an influx of illegal immigrants. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, says it's worried about reports that some EU countries have blocked the entry or forcibly returned asylum seekers and refugees.
For the EU governments, a refugee situation is just a migration situation among others, and they used to use migration control tools to deal with asylum issues on asylum seekers.
Back at the camp on the bridge, Prazi, the asylum seeker from Darfur, also has little faith in the political system.
The politician always came on the TV, on the radio, on the media, talking. You believe that, oh man, now I have a good chance, but there is no chance. Every time, new law, new work, new whatever, new. But nothing new for us, just new for them.
So asylum seekers here are counting on hope and a long wait. Lisa Bryant, DW, Paris.
Well, Denmark is heading for an election, and it could be as early as May. The Social Democrat Prime Minister, Helle Thorning-Schmidt, may take advantage of her increased standing in the wake of the shootings by an Islamist extremist who killed two people in separate attacks in February. The Schengen Agreement is also likely to be part of the election campaign, with right-wing politicians promising to reintroduce border controls. From Copenhagen, Malcolm Brabant reports.
Hello, Angus. Another hard-working day at the financial coalface?
Yes.
How are the markets today? Are they bullish, bearish, or just plain greedy?
A little bit of everything, I think.
Right, OK. Where are we going?
We're
going
to go by bicycle to Sweden. So I'm leaving my office in Denmark and I'm going home to another country.
Put your helmet on.
Yeah, helmet. I always wear a helmet.
Meet Angus Walker, financial journalist, the quintessential new European, a Briton transplanted to Scandinavia, a commuter without borders.
People in the office always say, so you come all the way from Sweden, as if it's some great feat of endurance. And I think to myself, well, it takes me an hour and a half door to door. I'm about to get on the bike. It takes me 5 minutes to ride to the station, get on the train. 1 hour later, I'm in Sweden, get off, ride my bike home, another 5 minutes. It really is quite a simple journey. The Schengen visas made it entirely possible for people like me to live and work in Europe, to take advantage of all the possibilities there are for work, for life.
Your attention, please. We will be at Copenhagen Central Station in a few minutes.
This region wants to market itself as Copenhagen, Malmo and Lund, with its university to a large extent, being a kind of Scandinavian Silicon Valley, being a centre for startups, creative industries, and it relies entirely on the free movement of skilled people. Can you imagine if there was passport control and customs to go through? It just wouldn't work in the way it does.
We have to get used to reintroducing the border control, both in the airports and on the other borders, which I think is very, very important. Schengen was a total disaster, not only for Denmark, but for the rest of Europe.
Speaking in the wake of the Valentine's Day shootings in Copenhagen, Søren Espersen, the foreign affairs spokesman of the Eurosceptic Danish People's Party. After an Islamist gunman killed two and injured five, the DPP is threatening to withdraw from the Schengen area. The issue will be in their manifesto for the forthcoming election.
If you notice, something happens when terror is happening, when violent things are happening, the first thing that happens is that the borders are closed. It's ludicrous to imagine that we can have a completely free Europe where people can go from country to country. That must end.
I found the opposing view in Greenland, a country sealed off from the outside world by nature. It couldn't be more different from a Europe without internal frontiers. Paying a visit was Denmark's Foreign Minister Martin Lidegaard.
I have to say that I don't think the answer to the terror threat we are experiencing these years is to close our borders. In the opposite, I think that the best we can do is to take a closer eyes on our external borders and then cooperate more across the borders internally in the EU. That's how we're going to deal with organized crime and terror.
You're welcome on board, new passengers. This next stop will be Hylje. Next stop, Hylje.
We're now crossing this stretch of water called the Øresund, which is pretty narrow, that separates Sweden from Denmark. And we're on the bridge itself, which divides the two countries. Well, not that divides them, but which joins them together.
And we've crossed the border now.
That was painless, wasn't it?
Yes, you get an announcement about putting your bags up on the shelf or under your seat, but you don't hear any announcement that you've just crossed from one country to another.
Thanks, Malmö Central. Malmö Central.
Right, Malmö Central. I'm getting off.
That's it. And my two-country commute nearly over. Sweden, home sweet home.
But if the right wing wins the Danish election, will this freedom of movement still be possible? Malcolm Brabant, DW, Malmö, Sweden.
And I'm Helen Senian-Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. Thanks to Schengen, it's possible to travel from the toe of Italy to Norway's North Cape without stopping at a border or even showing your passport. But two decades after the zone was created, a European's taking this freedom for granted. Kerry Skyring travelled to the Czech-Austrian border, to a place with the unlikely name of Excalibur City.
This is on the main road between Vienna and Prague. It's now a Schengen border, which means practically no border. But in the early 1990s, this place was really quite a frustrating border crossing. There would be traffic jams for up to an hour, as you had two passport checks, both the Austrians and the Czechs. Lots of police and weapons. So one could waste a lot of time at these borders. But now, as we approach it, I'm down to about 80 kilometres an hour, and I'm now in the Czech Republic. Nothing. And as soon as I cross into the Czech Republic, there is Excalibur City in all of its glory.
Excalibur City is a brash place, a combination of shopping centre and Disney-style theme park, loosely based on the legend of King Arthur and Knights of the Round Table. Complete with fiberglass dragons breathing smoke and mock castles. But it is very successful and draws visitors from all over Europe. Just pulling into the car park is a coach unloading tourists and shoppers from Ukraine, a country obviously not in the EU or the Schengen zone. Their tour guide, Sophia, wishes it was otherwise.
Yesterday we was in Austria, Hungary, and now we go to Czech Republic, and we must have a visa. We want to will be in Schengen zone and traveling without.
Excalibur City began to grow out of a dusty field two decades ago, just before the Schengen Agreement came into effect, in what was then a much smaller EU. But Czechs and Austrians had to wait until the Czech Republic joined the EU in 2004 and then enter the Schengen Agreement the following year before they could cross this border freely. Next door to Excalibur City is the Freeport Centre, a shopping complex owned by a British company. Its Czech director, Jan Prohatska, remembers the transformation as the border controls evaporated.
All the passport and car check are gone. Also the queuings on the roads was also gone. This was not anymore. But the main difference to our business was that people from Austria willing to buy proper and quality clothes came to Czech Republic for shopping, not only to travel for cheap food and fuel and others.
Jan says the visitors to his center are split about 50-50 between Austrians and Czechs. The tour buses from Eastern Europe mainly visit Excalibur City and the theme park. He says much of the cross-border shopping success of his center is that it opens on days when Austrian retailers are closed. But could his upmarket operation exist without Schengen?
It would be, but probably not so optimistic. Yeah. I think that after opening the border, we noticed really huge increases both in footfall and sales.
Excalibur City is still growing. Gambling casinos are sprouting Las Vegas-like out of the fields, and a big American-style hotel has recently opened, and a small airport as well. Hirt Kobel and his wife Maria are Austrian pensioners who've driven about half an hour to buy cheap cigarettes and have lunch. Hirt has memories of the Iron Curtain, the period after it fell, and now the Schengen era.
Schengen-Abkommen bedeutet für Österreich.
For Austria, the Schengen Agreement means community, solidarity, and yes, peace as well.
I suggest to Hirt and Maria that there might be some disadvantage to open borders. Don't they feel less secure?
Of course, this is the big disadvantage. All of those thieves take things from us and then they're away. You know, that's the negative side.
Once, nobody wanted to live here, and for good reason. When it really was a border, people could only easily travel in one direction, away from it. Now, in the entire complex around Excalibur City, about 2,000 people are employed. Simone, from the nearby Czech town of Brno, is here on a shopping trip. What does she think about the coachloads of tourists from Eastern Europe out in the car park?
I think they are taking our jobs, because they are not so paid as us, as Czech people, so it's better for companies to take people from Hungary or Ukraine or something like that. But for Czech means no jobs.
Despite that reaction, Simone is a big fan of the open border. Just a few hundred meters away from where she's speaking.
For me, it means freedom. And I think it's the basic thing for me and the most important.
Kerry Skyring, DW, Excalibur City, on the Czech-Austria border.
Drop us a line if you have a comment or query on the program. Our email address is europe@dw.de. That's europe@dw.de. Or write to us the old-fashioned way at Inside Europe, the English Department, Deutsche Welle, Bonn, Germany. We always enjoy hearing from you. In the meantime, that's all we have time for on the show, and I hope you enjoyed it. It was produced with help from Karl Nasman, Gabriel Baroud, and sound engineer Michael Springer. And I'm Helen Sini. Thanks for joining me. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany.